There is simply no telling who the music will reach and what it will do to them. A teenage girl from Tel Aviv who loves the Spice Girls could be converted to a jazz obsessive overnight with just a little encouragement from a teacher. And that same girl might move to New York City, become a fixture on the club scene, play with the great musicians, host her own radio show, and make records as both a singer-songwriter and a singing jazz guitarist. It could happen. Just ask Dita Pellet. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. I have been waiting to interview Dita Pellet since I first saw one of the music videos from her 2022 album, Love of the Tiger. That project, which she made with the much underappreciated genius producer Philip Weinrobe, positioned Pellet as a kind of freak folk singer-songwriter framed by electronic textures and with a sharp take on modern life as a woman. It had a fully formed aesthetic, a real musical point of view, and a kind of mystery to it. I was intrigued. And soon after, I discovered her radio show, The Dita Show, on Radio Free Brooklyn. She's interviewed an incredible range of artists, many of whom have also appeared here, like Monica Martin, Larry Goldings, Jesse Harris, Lau Noah, Rachel Price, Michael Levitin, Adam Levy, and Jake Sherman, along with many others who have yet to appear here. Her ease with people comes through immediately. You hear it on the show, and you see it on her Instagram, where she shares ideas about practicing and playing. I had the feeling I knew her before we'd ever met, like she might be a distant cousin of mine or something. So when I eventually got a message from her, sometime a couple years ago, I wasn't surprised, but I was excited. The producer Matt Pearson had been in the studio with her, making what would eventually become two albums, the first of which, I Wish You Would, has just been released. Somewhere during those sessions, Matt mentioned my name to her, and Dita did what she does. She followed up, and she reached out. I'd been following along as they documented those sessions. A small but mighty band had been assembled. Tony Scher on bass, Kenny Wollison on drums, Sullivan Fortner on keys. It was recorded by Chris Allen. I remember thinking what a smart, focused choice it was for an artist with such wide-ranging instincts to make a contained, coherent record with a group like that. So Dita and I met for coffee in Brooklyn after she wrote to me, and it felt exactly as I expected, like catching up with somebody I already knew. And I don't think I'm the only one that has that experience with her, which probably says less about me and more about how she moves through the world, open, funny, curious, and ready to connect. I Wish You Would is a blues-focused record drawing from deep cuts by John Lee Hooker, Buddy Johnson, Billy Boy Arnold, Mary Lou Williams, and Gladys Shelley. She embodies material that in many cases was written and performed in another era, often from a male perspective. She doesn't rewrite them so much as inhabit them and bring them into her life. Sometimes that means changing a place name. Sometimes it means changing a point of view. Sometimes it just means singing a lyric as it is and letting the meaning change because of who's singing it.
A little bit of love she gives you, then she's still away. A little of a sweet smile, you think you got it made. But you can tell by the way she walks, it throws a maze.
A second album from the same sessions, which is tentatively titled I Wish I Was a Single Girl Again, is due later this year. It features more original material and a slightly different angle on the same band and approach. I dig Dita Pellet. She's hip, funny, swinging. A musician who sings with a knowing wink and plays with just the right balance of control and abandon. She knows that the blues hurt so nice, and she knows just how to inflict that beautiful pain. We got together recently to talk about how sometimes the only way to become yourself is to go somewhere where no one knows who you are. She told me the story that led her out of Israel to pursue everything that, for her, is real. See what I did there? And along the way, she told me how she discovered the truth about her sexuality, her singing, and the six strings that she loves so much. If you ask her, she might tell you that she especially loves the G string. See what I did there? But you know, that's not just a silly joke. It actually points to something essential about Dita's artistic identity. For example, the cover of her new album features her black leather boot resting on the naked backside of her wife, Lee. And a recent single shows her from behind, wearing assless chaps and holding a guitar. Her videos and press images are a long way from what you might expect in the jazz world. As she told me, I think I like being the person who is not doing what is expected. Third-story.com is the place to sign up and subscribe. Visit the archive. It's hundreds of deep dives like this one, including the aforementioned episodes, as well as conversations with other brilliant guitarists like Lage Lund, Julian Lage, Lionel Luecke, Steve Kahn, Matthew Stevens, Ella Feingold, Charlie Hunter, Vil Rie, Madison Cunningham, and Nels Klein. And other Israeli icons have made appearances here too, like Noga Erez and Achinoam Nini. Visit the Substack for all the latest writings, episodes, and musings. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember, we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for all of their award-winning content. By the way, quick note, I have a few gigs coming up in New York. I'll be playing Sunday, May 17th at City Winery, playing keys with the Slim Kings. I'll be singing a little bit at Joe's Pub with Michael Hurst on Thursday, May 28th, and I'll be at Mesro on June 5th and 6th, joining my father, Ben Sidran. Here's me and Dita Pellet talking it down. Dita Pellet.
We started?
Of course.
Okay, woo!
With you, I'm very aware of how this whole thing goes because you do this too.
That's right.
And when we first met, that was the first thing that we talked about. How do you do it? How often do you do it? Where do you do it? How do you find people? How do you know all of it? How do you get noticed?
Yeah.
How do you make video? All those things.
Yeah. I'm going to step into like an interviewee vibe, but you have to watch out because they might attack you with questions.
Do you have an easy time switching from one mode to the other, from being the person who's being interviewed to the person who's curious and asking the questions?
I think so. I think I was pretty good at interviews recently, and when I interview people, I don't like try to make them interview me. So yeah, that's easy when someone else is around to interview them.
Yeah.
Usually when people interviews me, I'm open and like, yeah, I'm playing the interviewee part.
A role.
But it's like I like to have a normal conversation. I feel like because we know each other a little, it's naturally going to happen, but I would love to speak about the things you want to talk about.
Well, when you just arrived, I mean, one thing that happens for me in these conversations is somebody comes in and as you're taking off your shoes and your coat, and my daughter just made you a cup of matcha, which I'm so proud of her watching her make this for you. You start telling me about your morning and I said, don't say anything interesting because I feel like those first moments are the most interesting.
For sure. When someone comes to my radio show, I always try to tell them that like, we're going to have like 10 minutes of silence until we start so that we won't like waste the nice convo.
Do you actually spend silent time with people?
I try, but it's really hard. It's embarrassing. And
you just kind of look at each other awkwardly?
We always say something, but I tell them, let's try not to get into conversations because it's going to be too good.
It always is good. And in fact, as much as you promised that it would be boring, and it was pretty...
Pretty
you made
boring.
A great effort to make it boring.
Yeah, thank you.
So many things came up. For example, last night you played a gig.
Yeah.
It was the first night of Seder.
That's right.
Of Passover.
Yeah.
You know, you're from Israel.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what your interaction is as an Israeli coming to interface with all of these American Jews that have a potentially a deeper connection to certain rituals than maybe you would have had growing up in Israel.
Right.
I don't know. That's
I
an
mean,
assumption.
Growing up in Israel... We had seders, but you know, my family never reads the Haggadah. How do you say it here?
Yeah.
Haggadah?
How do you say it?
Haggadah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't read it.
Yeah.
I wish they would read it a little. It's a nice tradition. Yeah. But yesterday I called them when they were doing seder and like, are you reading it? And they were like, no. So they don't really do it seriously.
Yeah.
Since I moved to New York, which is almost 17 years ago.
Wow.
I did have a lot of friends seders. Which is really fun. And if I haven't had a gig yesterday, I would probably go to one.
Yeah.
But when I booked the gig, I forgot. I didn't look at the date and think it might be Passover. So I just booked it. And I'm not like so sad I'm missing it, you know?
Well, it goes on. We have our Seder on the third day.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. We always made a Seder for families and friends who might go somewhere else for the first night or the second night. And then this is like an extension of
nice.
The thing.
So who's coming?
See, look at you.
I know.
Look what you just did.
I know, I'm trying to get myself invited.
You want to get invited?
Maybe.
I love it. The other thing that you told me in your boring story about your car getting towed is that, I forget exactly how you framed it, but you said, my wife and I went to move the car or whatever. And my understanding is, if I'm reading your social media right, that you recently got married.
Yeah, we got married a year ago, but we recently posted about him like pictures from our wedding day. It was just at City Hall, yeah?
Yeah.
So people think it was now, but it was a year ago. And we said, this is our anniversary. So it was our first year anniversary of getting married at City Hall.
What was it about not posting a year ago? Why didn't you post a year ago?
Because we thought we were going to do a big wedding and that our small ceremony was just for us because we wanted to get it done anyway.
Yeah.
So we wanted to keep it kind of private. So when we do a ceremony and a wedding,
yeah,
it will still be surprising for most people or like be meaningful. But then a year passed and we don't even know when we'll do the wedding yet. We hope we will do it, but yeah, you know, life happens and we don't have a plan. So we're like, okay.
Yeah.
And most people in our lives know already. So we just felt like it's a silly secret.
It was a way of making it public. I mean, I met your wife at some point in the last 12 months. I did not realize that you were married. It doesn't really,
yeah.
I don't know exactly what the difference is, but
it, we don't do, but we needed to do it for some other reasons, like bureaucracy stuff. So it does help us. So that's why we did it. But we do love being wives and like we're excited to have a wedding at some point, but we're just being distracted by other things we were taking care of.
You moved to New York 17 years ago or to the States 17 years ago?
New York.
Straight to New York.
Yeah, where will I go? Colorado? That's where our car is from.
Let's talk about what your life was like before that. You grew up in Israel.
Okay, yeah.
Where?
In Tel Aviv. I went to that high school everyone went to. Every good musicians you know, Israeli musician, you probably went there. It's called Thelma Yelin.
Okay.
Or Thelma Yelin. I don't know how you say it here. Really, really amazing jazz program. That's where I really learned jazz. I got exposed to it and was obsessed with it for like 3-4 years at school. I didn't know anything about jazz before. I auditioned with like some jazz, you know, pieces on guitar that my guitar teacher taught me, but I didn't know what I'm doing. I was just like, you know, I played Take Five and stuff, but I just learned how to do it by heart. I didn't understand jazz and like a blues. But again, I wasn't improvising. I was learning a blues piece, you know, with tablature. So I didn't know anything. And then 3 months in, an amazing jazz piano player teacher taught jazz history. He was the coolest teacher. I think everyone that went to this school will tell you. He was our friend and he made us fall in love with the music. That all I cared about from 15 to 18 was Grant Green. Hank Mobley. Bebop and hard bop, Errol Garner. Kenny Dorham. Every time my dad would come to the States a lot, and every time he went, when I was younger, he brought me like Spice Girl stuff. I don't know, I was loving the Spice Girls. But once I started at high school, he started bringing me Grant Green CDs, Pete Bernstein.
Because was it difficult to find them?
I think it was CDs time, and yeah, it was easier to get it in America.
Yeah.
I think you can get it, but wow, it's so hard to imagine this time, right?
When were you born?
When? 1988.
So, internet-ish.
There was internet, I remember. There was like Napster. How do you call it?
Napster.
Napster, yeah. And like you can download some things.
Yeah.
But listening to CDs was more common.
Yeah.
I remember going to the store and buying CDs. I did buy CDs in Israel, but it was cheaper to buy it here.
And did he come to New York, your father? Where would he come?
He came to New York all the time.
So you'd say, give him a list. I want this Grant Green or Pete Bernstein
or
whatever.
Yeah, just bring me some Pete Bernstein, Grant Green.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kenny Burrell.
One of the things that I have felt out of a certain Israeli generation of musicians is a real modern sensibility, a more contemporary sensibility.
Really? I feel like I know more the people that are more like traditional.
Like you.
Many people went modern, but also I know a lot of people that have a lot of straight ahead in them, whatever direction they are going in. Also, I don't feel like I'm the most straight ahead person, but there's something modern, you know? It has to feel like it's now. Otherwise, I don't know, it doesn't speak to me at all. Like, I'm not trying to be nostalgic, you know? I don't like when people use this word with me. Like, if the song don't feel like relevant right now, it doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
But the feeling of the, like, yeah, how we play, how we sing. It has to be, no, I just like these things and I call musicians that like this tradition.
Yeah.
But the way we play it, it has to be.
That's a deep thing, to be rooted in tradition or part of a tradition, but also not nostalgic. And I can see, I guess, where people would be saying to you, oh, it's nostalgic. Well, no, we're going to talk about the record, I guess, a little bit, because here we are.
Like the sound, the way it was recorded, it doesn't sound like it's trying to sound like these old records.
The question of these songs feeling relevant today or not, like most of the material that you chose across two albums is about love.
Right.
The blues on some level.
Yeah.
I mean, these are things that do not go out of
fashion
or style, no matter what's going on in the world.
But I do feel like these songs, I don't know, the lyrics are not dated. A lot of songs are about love and pining and whatever we're talking about, and some of them feel dated a little,
yeah,
and some don't. So I feel like I usually have a tendency, a pull towards ones that feel like I could speak like that today.
Yes, conversational.
Yeah, conversational, and like, if the language is old, it has to be like fun. Like, I don't know, Hesitation Blues has a few things that people won't say today.
Like what?
She made me think about my parasol. Yeah, you know? If I had a woman, she was tall. She made me think about my parasol. How long do I have to wait? Can I get you now? Or do I have to hesitate? Touch my bonnet, touch my shawl, do not touch my waterfall.
She says, touch my bonnet, touch my shawl, do not touch my waterfall. How long do I have to wait? Can I get it now, or do I have to hesitate?
But I love it, it's like playful.
Well, these are lyrics that were primarily sung by men.
Totally.
If you go back and listen to some of the original recordings of these records.
Those are my favorite versions.
And these are men singing about women in their life.
Mm-hmm.
We are living a quarter of the way into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a radical act for a woman to love another woman publicly.
Yeah.
But in the blues, I don't know how many examples there are of these songs.
There are not a lot, I think, that sing to other women, but I think many of them were like at least bisexual. But most of them still, like, it's more common to hear a woman singing about men and the opposite.
So when you say, She made me
think about my parasol.
I don't know what we're talking about, but somehow it feels way more evocative from you.
I know. I like it. It's fun. But yeah, it's definitely, I'm aware of it.
She says, come in here, you dirty little soul. You're trying to be a bad girl, but you don't know how. How long do I have to wait? Or do I have to hesitate?
I wonder if that is part of the sort of modern aspect of what's happening, is taking these songs that, if the women were singing it, maybe they were bisexual, but many of the men, there was probably an enormous amount of latent homophobia running through blues culture for years.
For sure.
And here you are completely embodying these songs.
Yeah.
Making them true to your life.
Yeah. I think it is an aspect that makes it more modern or like more now.
Yeah.
Some of the lyrics, like only very few I change, but not related to like sex.
Yeah.
Related to, I don't know, like places, like from Brooklyn to Soho, I sing it blues in the night.
Yeah.
Just because, like, you know, it's places that are more relevant to my life.
From Brooklyn to Soho.
But then I kept them. From Kansas to St. Joe.
From Kansas to St. Joe.
But that also means something to me.
What does it mean to you?
Wherever the four winds
blow.
There was like one ex of mine that's from Kansas. Things like that.
All right, so we got derailed from the whole thing. Your dad's bringing you CDs back. It's like the 90s, I guess. Early 2000s.
And early 2000s.
You're in high school. You get completely turned on to this great music. And you had an incredible teacher, it sounds like, who really got
amazing.
You excited.
He passed away like 10 years ago, maybe a little more. Yeah, but he was so good. And yeah, he made us obsessed with like everything that Barry Harris was teaching. He learned with him. And he taught that to us. There were a few other great, really good teachers that I think were very meaningful, like, to have for all of the young students. I think many of us are in New York now playing, you know? So that was a big deal.
Would I know any of the people that you were in high school with? Are there other...
Maybe. Do you know Asaf Yuria? Great saxophone player. Gilad Hexelman, a few, they're a little older than me, but they went to the same school.
So Gilad is one of the most accomplished, like studied, obsessed over, interesting, innovative guitar players alive. Was that a thing for you? Like, oh, Gilad, you know, was he already playing
very,
like that?
I'm still a huge fan of Gilad, but when I was younger, I was, wow, I used to go see him play every time he would come back from New York because he's a few years, like 6 years older than me. So he was already in New York when I was in high school.
Yeah.
But when he came to Israel to play a show, I would always go, and I loved Gilad, and I think I took a lesson or a few with him at the time, and we became friends.
Yeah.
But he was also kind of like a teacher. Not that I didn't learn I didn't take so many lessons, but I took a few really good ones with him. And yeah, we're still friends. I love Gilad. He's someone I definitely look up to. We became very different in what we choose to play.
That's a good example of the kind of musician that I'm talking
about. Exactly. There are those two. It's amazing. It's so different from me. But I still appreciate it very much. And here and there when I get to play with Gilad, it's always magic. We know each other so well that I think we find something that works for both of us.
Well, you have this common root.
But I think the root is more the friendship than being Israeli. It was just knowing each other for so many years.
Yeah.
And like having the same teacher, like we're having the same background for sure.
Did seeing him go to New York and understand he was coming back from New York, was that part of what planted the seed for you? Oh, I could go to New York. That would
not
be a thing
only
to do.
Him, but definitely all of the great musicians that were a little older than me went to New York to go to school and start playing. So in my situation, I was already knowing, I already knew that I want to go to New York because I have two older siblings. And they both went to New York, not for music, just to study at the new school and like Hunter and NYU. Okay, so both of them went. So when I was younger, I used to go to every summer to visit one of them, whoever was here. They're both older than me by a good amount. Like my sister is 12 years older than me. So me and my brother would go to New York when I was so young and visit her for like 3 weeks. So I already fell in love with New York. And I knew that probably like my siblings, they'll also move here. I didn't even think about music yet. But then when I got into jazz and I saw all my idols also moving to New York and this great teacher was telling us about Barry Harris and like telling us that Pete is the best guitar player and we have to go listen to his music. So all of that made it even more clear to me that New York is where I'm going to go.
Are your siblings still here?
No. But my brother lived here for a long time after I already was here. So we had like time together here, but he moved back also to Israel.
Yeah. So how did you get here? Did you come here to study?
Yeah. When I was still in Israel, I auditioned to Berklee.
Yeah.
Because at that high school, we had like a show with a big band. I was in the high school big band at Berklee and they auditioned all of us and they gave me like a scholarship to the 5-week program. Yeah. And then there they auditioned us for the school and I got like a full scholarship to go to school. And then I told my parents, listen, I really prefer New York, but I'll consider Boston if I don't get a good scholarship in New York. So then I went to New York just to audition. And I got a great scholarship, and my parents were like, okay, go do whatever you want. Go to New York.
So where'd you, NYU, New School?
Where'd
you
go? New School.
New School.
So I just moved to the New School.
Yeah.
At 20 years old.
So at 20. So did you finish high school at 19? Oh, did you military? What happened?
I did military, yeah. I don't know if it's cool to talk about these things these days, but I can do it a little bit. I was in the Army band. Just like, you know, the
you
Army
know,
today is so something else.
I was wondering what it's like for you and just what it's like to be Israeli. I mean, I know what it's like to be an American Jew who has a very little relationship with Israel.
Yeah.
And even before all this, I was always clear to say, like, I don't really understand Israel. Like, it's not my lived reality, you know? And culturally, there is a kind of sometimes a familiar sense of meeting Jews from anywhere for me.
Yeah.
You know, it has nothing to do with religion. It's just like us. But on the other hand, has nothing to do with my life. Ultimately.
Totally. Israeli is a different animal than like Jewish.
Yes, it's exactly.
It's totally a different vibe. It's a culture that's different from being American. But what's happening these past few years in Israel is very hard for Israelis that I know and for me. Because the country is becoming like a crazy place with horrible government that no one wants, except of the whole other part of Israel that I don't even know them. But, you know, so it just becomes very depressing that this is what I've become from Israel.
What do you think it would be like to be in the military doing your military service today?
I don't think I would go.
What would you do instead?
It's hard to get out of it, but I would get out of it. There's some ways. They also existed then. I got this very cool job in the Army that's called Extraordinary Musician, which you audition and like 10 people a year get it, I think in classical and 10 in jazz or something like that. And if you get it, you get really nice conditions where you don't have to be there all the time because you are
extraordinary.
Extraordinary, and you have to like practice and like keep taking lessons. I remember I went to New York for 3 weeks to take lessons with someone, you know, they let you like do special things. So you keep your career and they don't like, you know, ruin the culture, because people that practice many years can take 2 years off or 3 years off. So they have it for dancers, for musicians. So I got that and that's why I did it. But I thought to myself that if I won't get something special like that, I would probably try to get out of it. I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't do a regular thing in the Army.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was really lucky, and I actually enjoyed doing it. It was basically like being a musician, but my audience was like people in the Army. So like other people my age in Israel, and I love the people that I played with. They came from my high school and were like super fun. It was a very experimental time for me. I started singing then, because before I was just a guitar player, and because I was a little bit out of my regular surrounding by like the jazz people, I was with like weird classical people that I really loved in my ensemble at the Army. So like it gave me a new environment to experience. And I was a little shy to sing next to my friends from high school from the jazz department. But with them, I was like, listen, I want to sing now. I don't know. I started exploring other things.
What did you start singing? What were the first things you sang?
In the very beginning, because I was playing jazz, I learned like Sweet Lorraine and Loverman and stuff like that. I had a boyfriend at the time. I made him a tape with these songs with his name instead of like the names of the whatever was the song. But then I started singing like rock, Israeli rock from the 90s that I loved, or like Nirvana, or just songs, you know, that I started singing, but it was all very secret. I didn't want, like, I was very shy about it. But that was my biggest passion, like to sing. And I like, that's why I loved being in that ensemble, because like no one knew me really. I could, and also I just did it a lot by myself. And only when I moved to New York, I started feeling more confident to like sing at places and stuff. Not because I was way better. I wasn't so good at the time. I was a great guitar player, but I was new to singing. But the reason is no one knew me. I think when people know you and expect something of you, it's really hard to change. But when you're in a new place, no one knows me. I had like a wine bar gig every week. And like, you know, I call like a bass player I never met before. So I just said, hey, I'm Dida. I play guitar and sing, you know? So there wasn't like this awkwardness of like, I'm going to sing now.
Yeah. Did you have a voice when you heard yourself? Did you think, I should be doing this? This is the right direction.
I had to work on it a little.
Yeah.
I think I always sounded like distinct a little.
Yeah.
Out of limitation. I feel like I was never like a diva or like a naturally amazing singer. Like, yeah. I don't know. I didn't get into high school's choir. Not high school. The school before. Elementary school choir and stuff. I wasn't like singing from the day I was born and like, you know. But then when I started, I did have a good ear. I was playing guitar and stuff. So I sounded nice, but I had to develop it. And I also felt like I had a voice from the beginning, even though, again, a lot of work needed to be done. But at least it was a little different. So I feel like
That was a big deal.
I think even Matt told me, the producer, Matt Pearson,
that
he heard me like at Fat Cat when I, a few years in New York. And that he thought I sound nice. And that the main thing was that he believed me. Like, and I had a special voice. He heard something that he doesn't hear all the time. And it's distinctive.
He told me last night, Matt Pearson, texting with him, because I was listening to the first of these two records that's coming out, the blues record.
I Wish You Would.
I Wish You Would. And then the second one is I Wish
I Was a Single Gal Again.
Two sets of wishes.
Exactly.
It feels very intentional, and it feels like they're related and that you knew what you were doing the whole time.
Yeah.
But I wrote to Matt and I just said, I Wish You Would is so killing. This is so great. Thank you for making this. And, and he said to me that he was waiting for 10 years to work with you.
Really?
That he wanted to work with you for a decade.
We've been in touch many years, and I always wanted to work with him too. Yeah. And this was our time. But I think he saw from back then that there's something.
You know, you talk about Loverman. I assume you had heard Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you were listening to female singers or to more male singers.
I love if you notice that by my singing, I do love male singers too. I think I listen to both a lot. Billie, honestly, I've been listening more in the past 5 years. I'm obsessed with Billie, but it wasn't like when I just started, I wasn't listening to her all the time.
Yeah.
I think I was more drawn to people that have a little bit a niche in jazz, like Blossom Dearie.
I was just about to ask you when Blossom Dearie entered.
Well, so when I moved to New York, I started playing around the first year. Yeah. Someone invited me to their house for dinner.
Yeah.
Made me pasta and play Blossom Dearie. It was the first time I ever heard her. And I was like, oh my God, it's the best thing I've ever heard. I have to learn all these tunes that she's singing. And I started sounding like her.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to... I still have something like her, but I also sound different.
I'm hip, I'm no square. I'm alert, I'm awake, I'm aware. I am always on the scene, making the rounds, digging the sounds. I read Playboy magazine, 'cause I'm hip. I dig.
But you have something, I mean, your voice, your range when you sing is much higher than your spoken voice, it seems to me.
Really? Sometimes.
Something that goes kind of like higher in your...
Yeah. Wait, you didn't even hear my electronic stuff there. I have a really crazy high voice there.
Well, I did hear Love of the Tiger.
My dog is not really barking. My door is not really open. We all got to keep our marks in every glass of sharks waiting for us to gulp them.
The story that you are essentially telling goes from Grant Green to Billie Holiday to Blossom Dearie to Matt Pearson to, you know, and yet there is this other part of your life, which is actually the first stuff of yours that I heard.
Yeah.
Which was contemporary production, more modern pop adjacent, not like it never felt like it was like, I'm going to try to be like a pop star.
Yeah, it's more like, I don't know, indie rock or like indie, I don't know. It's very, it has a lot of old school in it too.
Yes.
But in a different genre.
And then before that, you also had clearly been playing with Americana, not only musically, but like in the kind of presentation, the image, the way you dress, the whole kind of like visual aspect of what you did was leaning into the American South or Southwest in a way.
Yeah, I don't know why. I always like, my dad always told me I look good in a hat. And Jack Nice was kind of just happened. It's crazy because it's like the most listened to song of mine. And some people, like the first thing they think about me, people that don't know me, it's like, oh, Jack Nice.
Yeah.
When I end up lonely and cold on the side of some deserted road, Jack picks me up, treats me oh so nice, though he knows he too will pay the price. Jack
I thought it was too much of a like character song, yeah. and I wanted to take it off the record. Yeah. And that video, we came up with it in a week. It was like I was going to release another song from that record yeah. as a single, and my publicist told me like, "Why won't we warm people up with yeah. like
something
like,
they
something quick?" Like I had a show in south of Israel, and like yeah. they're like, "Can you make a quick video?" We did it in the desert there, and I did it, and then yeah, it was.
So is that Modern Love Song? Is that what it was
yeah.
called?
Yeah. So that was yeah my first attempt to do like original songs and like yeah. more of a. I don't know if the word is modern, but like, yeah, so not jazz record.
Did you see that there would have to be like some sort of a fork in the road that you're either going to choose jazz or not jazz as your
At
path?
At the time, I thought it's a, I need to choose.
Yeah.
Obviously, now I'm like going back and forth. So like, I don't feel like
yeah.
I have to choose anymore. I think I realize that both of the things are really me and I really care about both of them deeply. So yeah. I have to make all these things because if not, I'll be unhappy. So, and I feel like people, the music and joys that I have, like when you ask me about male singers, I feel like I do love a lot of male singers in jazz and not in jazz. Like Lou Reed is a huge inspiration on me. Neil Young, I don't know, many people, but also like Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole. So
I see a thread in all that.
Yeah.
And Dylan?
Jelly Roll Morton and Dylan. So I think all of that makes me sing differently no matter what genre I'm in. John Lee Hooker, like, yeah, so I pick songs and I like the singers, and then like it's jazz, it's blues, it's like a song.
Mose
Ellison, love him.
I mean, all these people are people who have that thing that Matt Pearson said about you. They're believable.
Exactly.
Let you
so I
feel
think
that
that's
they
where
believe it.
That's the thread
yeah.
between all of these records that I'm making.
Yeah.
Is that it has to be like a story I want to tell, and it has to work.
I think that we don't give a lot of times an audience enough credit to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Because genres, as we know, are constructions, they're inventions
yeah.
to sell things.
Yeah, yesterday I played like one of the songs from like a record like that at Mezzeron. People yeah. loved it. And yeah. then the two records that now we made, one Americana, one Blues, I played both of these on the show, and it's great. People are happy to hear different things. And also, it's not that different. When I sing and play it, it sounds like a song I sing and play.
Well, the Americana and blues construct is interesting. I remember whenever it was, it's a while ago now, a year and a half ago, that you went into the studio with this unbelievable band.
Yeah.
Your, I guess,
dream
maybe
band.
A band, dream band.
Absolutely.
And I thought you were making a record.
I thought too.
Yeah.
I just like, you know, I had 2 days with them and...
You had 2 days with Kenny Wallace and Tony Scher, Sullivan Fortner,
yeah.
and you. Quartet, small
yeah.
format.
Yeah. And we had 2 days and I was very excited. I haven't made a jazz record in a long time. And every time you make a record, it's a big deal. But that was really exciting. And I tried to prepare as much music as I can. So I brought a lot of songs. Also, I felt like, wow, like I'm making a jazz record. And like Matt and I thought... I'm making like the best of all of the things I did in the past 15 years and haven't recorded yet, singing and playing. So we met a few times, Matt and I, to go over the repertoire. Matt is really good at like, you
Matt,
know?
I think is, repertoire is a huge part of
Totally, and he's
does.
Really thoughtful, and it was really helpful to sit down and look at all the songs and see what...
How did it work? Did you suggest songs? Did he suggest them for you too?
He suggested a few, but... We ended up not doing those, even though he had great ideas. It ended up being more things that I was just playing for a long time. And I was really, you know, like best of things I was playing at shows. But he had great ideas that I considered, but it ended up not yeah. being that kind of record.
You had found these songs.
Yeah, every song I found was like, you know, for me, finding songs is like writing songs in a way. It happens once in a while when you're lucky. It's like, not like I'm going to now learn a song and it will be it. Like, it's special. It has to, like, be so important for you for a second. And, like, you have to make the song. And then you find your arrangement and, like, you know? So I feel like every song in this record, I know how it came to my life.
I love that. That finding a song is almost like writing a song. It doesn't happen
every
day.
It has that same yeah. revelation, like,
yeah.
moment when you're like, oh, my God. this is my song now. It haven't happened to me in a second, and I'm a little sad. Like, it's like, it's like when you don't write a song, or when you don't...
This is what I was going to say. You know, when you go long enough without writing a song, and it's, you look at yourself in the mirror sometimes and go, are you
really doing it?
Can you do this? What do you do?
Exactly. So it's the same with finding a song. Because when you find a song, you want to go on a jam and sing it. You want to like play a show because that song, you need to sing it tonight. But if you don't have it, it's a little sad.
Yes, I totally understand. And yet, on the other hand, you cannot force it.
Exactly.
So you were quite prepared because you had been doing these songs for a long time.
Yeah, most of them. I think a few were just songs I loved for a long time. And like this was my opportunity to sing them. But I haven't done it a lot.
And you just played them for the band in the moment? Had they been given anything?
I wrote charts, but I also, they're so good that, first of all, Sullivan knows every song that ever, you know, he knew all these songs. And then Kenny and Tony were played a bunch together before, in the year before the recording. So they also pretty much knew my material. I made like some charts to know, to make things easy for everyone so they don't have to think too much. And then, I brought 21 or 22 songs, and we thought we're making one record and we'll just try them all, or as many as we get to, and see what's the best. But then, because many of them were really great, Matt told me once, he was like listening to back to what we made, that he feels like we have two records and that dividing it like that made sense. And I agreed.
They're quite related. Some of the songs I actually felt like, oh, this could have lived on the other record.
Really?
Like,
I wonder which one. Because to me, it does feel very different right now.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know why, but specifically, I do play them all at shows, so it shouldn't be. But I can't see what can be in another album.
I guess what I'm saying is like, same band? Same you?
Yeah,
same...
but it sounds different. It has a different vibe. Which one did you like more?
I'm delighted by both of them. I'm very happy to have heard the blues record first.
Right, so it was smart to start with the blues.
I think so.
Me too. I think it's a little more cohesive than the other one.
I think it is,
but
too.
The other one has very like interesting things on it. So I'm happy it exists, but the blues is like very, from start to end, it's like one thing, which I'm really happy because I never made a record that felt like you can put it in a car and drive somewhere and not be surprised in a good way. Like you're taking for a ride, staying in the same vibe.
Hard to make that. And I think it's especially hard for those of us, although I think most of us this applies, who like a lot of different things.
Exactly. So like all my other records were like all over the place.
Yeah.
And this one, wow, I'm so happy that it's one thing.
Yeah.
And I also feel like visually I was able to make it into one thing.
Yeah.
And that makes me very satisfied. The other one is a little less, but it still like has a world.
Yeah. What I wanted to speak to was the idea that, you know, as you mentioned, that you had with Tony and Kenny, you had played a lot of these tunes before, because something that is just very clear about you, you play a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But yeah, I'm a New York musician. Yeah. I play at the venues a lot. But I feel like that's how it goes.
I think that's how it goes. And I wonder if the reason it seems different to me with you is because you're singing also.
Maybe. Or maybe I'm good at posting.
Maybe you're good at that aspect of it too.
No, I think it's also because I sing. So it's like more of a show.
It's more of a show, and it gives a sense. To me, all of this feels like, oh yeah, it's been leading towards something, like all of the regular gigs that you do. And like,
what is it supposed to lead? Because I'm wondering like, what's, if it's going to stay like this or I'm going somewhere.
I'm wondering if you have thoughts about this.
I have wishes, but like, I don't know if it's going to happen.
What are your wishes?
My wishes is like to have a booking agent and like start traveling more to play this music all over. It's really hard to get a booking agent. Even when I have great people that are going to try to help me, like Matt and other people on the label, it's still super hard. I don't know what exactly it is, but I still think it will happen. But you know how it is, like you have to start booking yourself, and then at some point the booking agent will be like, okay, she's touring already, maybe I should like help. I'm talking to people in Europe to go there for like a fall thing, and then like something in Midwest, and like I'm going to San Francisco next week. So I'm playing shows in places outside of New York, but it's always so much work. And I feel like I should do it way more. Like, why wouldn't I travel with this music and great musicians? And like, it's going to be amazing.
You talk about 17 years. It's a long time. You know, to me, I'm still kind of like, I still consider you to be like a recent discovery for me, even though it's been a number of years.
I'm hoping more people think that. Because by the way, about booking, I feel like booking agents, that's what I learned, will be like, let's sign this 24-year-old. Why would we sign like someone who's a little older and been around for so long? No one signed her so till now, so
that is such less, such a heavy thing. And I know in your interviews you must have talked about this also. Like, there are people around,
yeah,
who you talk to them and the story is they were signed and dropped. They were signed and dropped a bunch of times, or everybody thought they were going to be, it was just a matter of time before, you know, and it didn't happen. There's just so many of these stories, right?
I know. I'm actually super happy that I wasn't like getting a huge break so far, because it made me work super hard and like keep looking for what's the next thing I'm going to do and like make things myself as much, like, you know, every time you don't get those opportunities, you're like, if you keep going, you keep going, you know, that's a lot. Like, you have to make something new and exciting happen. So I feel like I'm happy. I like being in control. I like making things. So I don't really need someone to like, but I would like help with booking.
Well, that's great to name it and manifest it. I mean, this is what I was thinking is you host a monthly choir.
Yeah.
Where people come and sing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went one time and hopefully I'll come again.
Yeah,
and it was beautiful because it was very open and yet it was like super talented people, but a feeling of community. You play regularly in a lot of the same places. Ornithology, I think, was your kind of your base of operations for
a
while.
In the last 3 years, I've been playing there every month.
And so that became a kind of a community building thing. You interview people, which is a form of expanding and building community also.
Totally. I feel like in New York, I'm super like busy and have a beautiful community of musicians around me, and I'm super happy about it. I think, the dream or the next step that will be exciting will be to like take it more to other places as well.
Did you play as a side person when you came here? Were you playing
other
people's gigs?
Yeah, I was playing side person somewhat. I think I always kind of knew that my main thing is to be the leader.
Yeah.
But I definitely played fun side gigs as guitar with other singers. And I do, it's like always was less of my time doing that than being a leader. But I love playing, being a sideman here and there.
So new school.
Yeah.
4 years.
Yes.
And then at that point, you're 24.
Yeah. Then I was touring more, actually. I had, I was still based in New York. I stayed here. I went on, it was right when I released the Jack Nice thing and like modern love songs. And then a year after, I had another organ trio album.
Yeah.
So around those releases, I went to Europe a lot and Atlanta Jazz Festival. Like, I was busy moving around more, which I really loved. And then what happened? Then I moved to Chicago.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, just for like 8 months. I had a girlfriend for 7 years, like a long time, that she moved to New York to be with me. But then she got accepted to do PhD in philosophy in UChicago. And I moved with her to Hyde Park in Chicago. And actually, that was a really cool thing. I was a little scared of it, but Chicago is amazing for music. I was a little nervous, but it was actually so good to move. I met a lot of people, great musicians in Chicago. And by the way, for someone like me that loves jazz, but also other style, I met like so many people that are very move from one thing to another without thinking about it. They just know like American songs. So I really enjoy doing that there and meeting musicians that are like that. And
they must have loved you in Chicago.
Yeah, they really loved me. Really. I felt like the audience there respond to my music. Yeah. So well, I had like a moment and I met a lot of musicians, artists, like I made some music video there. So basically when we broke up quickly after I moved, not super quickly, but like, I don't know, 6-8 months after, in a good way, we're still good friends. It was just like, you know, we were together all of our 20s. It's like we grew apart.
7 years you said you were together?
Yeah. So it was like, who wants to be with the person they were with from like 21, 22? It's like too much. It was my first girlfriend ever. I wanted to live more.
I mean, I remember we did a brief interview years ago that only a little piece of it aired. But I think I remember you telling me that you actually didn't come out or even necessarily realize that you were gay until you came to the States.
Exactly. When I actually met her and like we started being together, that was the first time I was like, okay.
So America was very tied to, coming to New York was very tied to so many parts of your life.
Exactly. When I talked about the singing thing, I actually thought about this thing. I think I needed like a new environment to like explore other things I wanted to do and like let these options become options.
Getting to be so far away from home.
Exactly.
Whatever.
People that know me, family.
Yeah.
Then I could like allow myself to try things and like think about myself in a different way, which was really hard. It's so crazy how much changed in the last 10, 15 years. I feel like now it wouldn't be that hard, but maybe it's still hard for young people. I don't know. But at the time, I was really having some years of feeling shame and horrible and hoping that it won't be what's happening.
That is an interesting question about whether or not it's the same today. For like, you know, you just met my 14-year-old daughter who has seen so many of her friends.
Yeah, even when I told her, my wife, I was wondering if she feels it's weird or she hears about it all the time. She's like a kid in Park Slope.
Kid in Park Slope. So much fluidity and changing and availability to kind of assert yourself in a way that is new, I think, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is always a challenge to tell the people that have known you the longest that something fundamental about you is not what they thought it was.
Totally.
That causes stress on people because they have to adjust to some new reality.
Yeah.
But exactly, you said my wife, and she didn't blink. Of course not.
Yeah,
no,
that's but not. I still think about it as if like it's weird for like someone young. Should I not talk about it? I don't know. It's crazy.
Is it weirder to say wife than girlfriend?
That's another part. But this time I just thought
Is she going to think it's interesting that I...
Yeah, that I'm
unusual?
Yeah. Yeah, but wife also feels like a little heavier, but in a fun way. I don't mind.
I think it feels heavier for straight people too. I think wife...
Yeah, wife.
Wife is like, oh, she's a serious. She's an adult. She made
I know, but saying my girlfriend feels like weird because we got married. But you got it.
Okay, so...
So wait, we're talking about Chicago.
So the relationship ends, and I imagine that maybe you had this moment where it was like, so do I stay in Chicago even though the thing that brought me here is over?
Totally. So for a second, because I really liked it, I was going out a lot. I was playing at the cool venues. Yeah.
Where would you play?
The Whistler and like Hungry Brain.
I don't know that one.
And like there's an amazing festival that's called Postdoc. It's in a farm in Wisconsin.
Oh.
And like the coolest musical family in Chicago organizes it every year. And that's a family I got obsessed with. They're both of, like the daughter and the son, I mean, they're my age, are amazing musicians. Liam Kazar and Seema Cunningham, both great indie musicians. And their parents are so cool.
Since you're gone, I sleep too much. The son and I don't keep in. Passersby say, looks like nobody's home.
So they organize the festival with the people that own the Postdoc farm that are also amazing couple. And they invited me to play there twice or even three times. I don't remember.
Wow.
But it's a fun festival. They bring great bands and everyone camps and stuff.
Yeah.
In the summer. So yeah, the breakup happened and I was like, should I stay here? Because I met cool people and I'm like, I love playing here. But then I was like, no, I want to go into New York because, you know, I was going through a breakup and I wanted to be around like people I'm close to. And New York still sounded cooler to me. But I kept going back, by the way, to Chicago to keep those relationships going. So to play gigs, to play that festival. So I was working on Love of the Tiger at the time.
Yeah.
And I met a really cool cinematographer, like a director. And we made Sylvia, the music video, and Showgirls. And I kept going there to play shows. I should do it more now. But as you see, I'm very invested in a New York scene and I'm a little lazy with like organizing tours. But I do think it's very fun and important when I do that.
Well, it would point you in the direction that you want to go.
I know, but sometimes because I'm lazy, I'm like, do I really want to go there? Because like, why am I not doing everything to make it happen? But I'm just so busy with other stuff.
So let's talk about what you are busy with. What's a day? What do you do? What are all the things?
I mean, it really changes a lot. But I don't know. Yesterday I had a gig. Today I have a gig. So like a few times a week, usually I play.
Yeah.
During the day, if I'm a good girl, I would like practice a little bit.
What is practice? How long and what are you practicing?
It depends. I'm not like in a very deep practicing mode right now. Yeah. I'm a little... But it happens sometimes. Sometimes when you release a record, you become like a computer person. You have to make so much visual stuff. So that takes a lot of my... I also really enjoy making videos and like album covers. I get very inspired and like I have a vision and I want to make it happen. And it's like bringing out the producer in me. So during a release, usually I'm like, I have so many things to do. Like, so I'm really a producer in those times, which I enjoy a lot, but I'm a little, the musician in me is sometimes a little sad. Even though when I play the shows, it's great. I just need to have a lot of shows to like keep. But if I have to sit at home and be in this, you know, sacred practicing zone, it's hard when you have all these exciting productions you can put together. Okay, so my life recently was a lot of producing things. I'm like also printing vinyl and CDs. So I had like to work with a designer and making it nice. And yeah, and like interviews. In the last few weeks, I had a lot of interviews. That was fun. So then, when I do practice, I practice like guitar. I transcribe something. I try to like analyze some things and then like take them to another direction, you know? Like, let's say I transcribe Coltrane and then I'm like, wow, he's playing this instead of this. Let me try it on another song. Like,
and you share those ideas. I mean, I do. Do you teach or is
it most... I do teach. Oh, yeah. And I'm also teaching. So that's another part of my week. I have like, I don't know, between 5 to 10 students a week. So that's also like time consuming and I love teaching.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I'm exercising a little. Like I like to have fun with like my wife and my friends.
This thing that you describe about all of the non-musician things that we do that support the artist's life, the work, I am like actually like a Excel spreadsheet person. Mm-hmm. I just got super into it.
Yeah, we all are super nerdy. I know.
And I also am constantly punishing myself to myself, going, this isn't the music, this isn't the job.
I think so many of my musicians friends so much enjoy that part and like being organized and stuff.
Yeah.
Musicians are sometimes a little mathematicians and we like to-do lists. We like scheduling. So I think we should all like embrace it in ourselves.
Accept it.
Also, you also know that like, I have also the radio show. That's like every week. All the things that I have every week or every month also take a lot of my time.
So you do the radio show every Friday.
Every Friday, and they don't like cancellation. So like, it's kind of hard. And then because I also do the video stuff.
Yeah. And you're still doing the video stuff?
I do, but I'm a little lazy. For example, I still video it, but I haven't like, I have 3 shows waiting for me to put it together.
Do you edit the audio?
No. I don't edit anything because I don't have time.
Yeah.
And I also kind of decided that, wow, maybe it's people that like it will like it anyway. And yeah, just try to make it good and without editing, even though editing would have been nice, but it would just take so much time. I don't feel like I can let myself do it. It will be a full-time job.
I think I made the mistake early on of doing a lot of editing. I do a lot of editing. And it
so this is going to be like super edited?
Depends. I mean, maybe it won't be. Maybe I'll announce now this was not edited. But I'll put some music in and I do some things and I cut some things. And if I
honestly
don't like where it went.
It's exciting. I think it should be edited. Why am I not doing it? Also, listen, mine is a live radio. So I think I have an excuse. This is the vibe.
Yeah.
But the video also takes time to put together. Not so much. I become fast, but sometimes I'm just not in the mood to do it. You know, like who wants to look at themselves and listen to the whole thing right away?
But that's when editing, the first thing that happens when I edit is I remove more of myself than the guest because I don't like to hear myself as much as I want to hear the other person.
I had someone doing it for me for a while.
I remember.
But it's hard to keep it going consistently because it depends. Either she gets busy or I'm not in the... I feel like I'm doing it better, not because of her. She's amazing, but you always do a little better with what you want to get, you know?
I mean, one thing that I've been trying to manage is I lose by delegating to somebody else in terms of what I think it should be.
Yeah.
But I gain in, first of all, having somebody to help me. And second of all, in maybe having it be different in a good way that I just hadn't imagined that it should be. Because I think when you make things yourself, when you're able to make things, it's very easy to get super controlling about
stuff. Totally. So I think, finding the right person to do it is probably smart. Same with like why I had like Matt produce the record. It's like if I would try to do all the edits and all the things, I'm able to do it. But it was really nice to have someone like making some choices for me, especially with something so personal, like a take. And like you get too much into details, you become not the right person for it, you know?
Yes. It's funny because we know more about ourselves than anybody else knows about us, and yet we can see ourselves the least sometimes.
Exactly.
I want to talk to you, by the way, unrelated, guitar sound on this record.
Yeah.
A lot of mic sound, and is that what it is?
Yeah, it's the mic sound. Yeah, I always ask them to put one mic just on the fingers, you know? It's always the greatest mic. People sometimes don't think they'll use it because they think they will separate the vocals from the thing, but usually the take is, you know, you don't need... My best takes are playing guitar and singing at the same time, and if it was good, there's no problem that the guitar will be in the... a little bleeding into the vocals. So...
That's right. But on the Tiger record, I'm sure those are overdubbed vocals.
Not all of them. No.
Really?
Many of them are live.
Really?
I worked with someone who has a very specific, how do you say it? Like when you have a way of living and you show everyone, what do you call it?
Philosophy, a strategy?
Yeah, philosophy.
Who?
His name is Philip Wainwright.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Amazing. And
so good and so inspiring. I tried to record songs from Love of the Tiger for like a few good years, and I made versions that were fine, but not it.
Yeah.
And that's because they weren't live. And when I met Phil, he told me, Dida, let's just take the band upstate. It was super pandemic time. So it's like, you know, we all tested before and went somewhere and stayed for a week. And he was like, we're going to do it to tape. And we're going to get to a good take of all of us playing and you singing and playing with us at the same time, like you would do in the show. I was playing a lot with the same people and we had a vibe.
Yeah.
And then once we got a good take, we did overdub and produced it a little. But the take is the take.
Mm.
So I think that's what clicked to me, that even when I'm making other styles of music... The approach, because I'm a jazz musician and I usually play with jazz musicians, we play well.
Yeah.
It sounds better when it's a take. So I always like to, now I change and I don't want to do, I mean, unless I'm doing something completely like electronic stuff, I think the vibe is to do a take that has the feeling of people playing together in a room.
Yes.
Once it feels good, it's easy to like do things to it, but... For some reason, it doesn't work for me when it's not like singing and playing together and that playing in the room with the band.
Well, maybe that's part of the sound of the guitar I'm even talking about is all of the bleed and all of the sort of
The
air and the sound of the room and all that stuff.
Yeah. I was a little worried before recording this record that we're going to be in different rooms. But
no,
Matt and Chris are very pro and they made it sound like, I mean, we did play together. And to me, it sounds like we're in the same world.
Yeah, you were certainly in the same world.
Yeah, but the philosophy of the other guy was like, let's be in the same room, you know?
And no headphones even.
Maybe I was in a different room with headphones, but yeah.
That kind of vibe, though.
Yes, that vibe.
We talked about this before because, of course, until recently, that was the newest music was the Tiger record.
Yeah.
And you had this song about Sylvia.
Yeah.
What is it? Sylvia lost her...
sense of being a woman.
Which is inspired by...
someone who had to go through surgery to take out her uterus. Like many women are recommended to do if they have, you know, chances of having cancer.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt actually was... she passed away from cancer and 10 years before a doctor recommended she will take it out and she didn't. So that woman did it. Hysterectomy, it's
called?
Yeah,
hysterectomy, yeah.
Yeah, and... I was moved by her because she got very depressed after. I know that.
And is she a friend? Or you read about her?
I don't want to say who she is, but she's not someone I know closely.
Okay.
It's someone I met when I was away somewhere. And I just knew that that's what was happened to her. And I saw her coming out of that depression. And I thought, wow, like that's the song is about like coming out new from something.
Yeah.
And like she was free from all the, I don't know. Losing her fertility, youth, things that made her like, you know, she knew herself in the world having those things. And then you're totally a different person. Generally, like there's a lot of difficulty around like, you know, menopause and like, yeah, I'm not there yet, but I know of people that are and it sounds hard. You lose yourself as a woman in a way.
Sylvia lost her sense of being a woman. Sylvia lost her sense of being a woman. From now on, it only gets better.
There was some sort of like some energy coming from you at that time about what it is to be a woman.
Totally. Skinny also, another song there. I think just like things I was thinking about as a woman.
Skinny, she's so skinny. She used to be a fat little girl. Screaming, she just won't see me. She's looking at the whole wide world.
And then on the same record, you had this Showgirl song.
Yeah.
Showgirls, they don't make them like they used to. Wouldn't make it to the crossroads. Well, they don't care about it anyway.
That one was related to like aging.
Yeah.
Even though I don't know why I'm thinking so far in the future, but sometimes I'm like that. My favorite kind of songs, not by me, are like songs that are about women that had it all and lost it all, or like living in regret, or like a Rolling Stone. How does it? Yeah, that song, or like They Hunt Me. I think about these songs a lot, or like Sophisticated Lady.
With this illusion deep in your eyes, you learn that fools in love soon. The years have changed you somehow. I see you now.
So I feel like I like to think about like the worst thing that can happen to you in the future. Something like that.
Wow.
Or like, I don't know, maybe I'm like thinking about other women in my life, like my grandma or my like.
So what are you writing about now? Are you writing?
Not really right now. I'm telling you, I'm a computer person, I'm a producer.
Yeah.
I think I should be, me and Lee should be a production team.
Yeah.
We're so good at it.
Well, so she's, okay, let's close with you and Lee.
Yeah. But I can tell you that the last time I wrote stuff was with Lee. I have a group of friends in Montreal that are super cool.
Hmm.
And they do every few months, they call it The Method. And they do... They say, okay, we're writing songs for a month. Who wants to participate?
Yeah.
And if you participate, you do a song every 3 days. Yeah. They give a prompt. And so in a month, you write 10 songs. And Lee and I did it together 3 times. So we wrote like 30 songs in the last year. But it feels casual, like not songwriting, because we kind of do it on the way. But we wrote really cool ones. Some of them are cool, you know, 30 songs. There are a few good ones.
Yeah.
So that was a really fun process. And I think... we learned that we're really good at making things together.
I have met her and I can see from the way that you present your life that like, yeah, you guys are a team.
I didn't plan for this whole, like the visuals of this record to be so, you know, she would participate so much, but she just came to help me out when I did the shoot that maybe was going to lead to the album cover. And then we did a whole like regular shoot.
Yeah.
Even though we found these cool leather chaps in Santa Fe.
Yes.
And then... I brought it as one of the options for the shoot and it looked cool. It has like my initials DP on it. That's the album cover. And then at the very end of the shoot, Lee was like, can we do something? And like she took her clothes off and like I put my boots on her back and that became the coolest shot. So that's the album cover. But after that, I don't know. I just like her being around. We went for Christmas to Idaho where she's from and that was the only time we had to shoot a music video. So we made that at the local strip club in Idaho, and that was really fun. And somehow she just became in all of the videos because it's just, we love making things.
But there is a sexually provocative thing happening. I mean, you haven't...
It's not that provocative, but I guess in jazz it is. I feel like there's so much more provocative things these days, but for jazz it is...
As a straight man, if I made the same album cover that you made
and
put my wife's naked bottom on it and my boot on it, I don't know.
No, I think it only works because we're women and we're gay.
Yeah, and it's cool and it reads as cool and sexy.
Guy friends in my life are kind of jealous that we can do whatever we want and get away with it. Or like even be like, people like it. But yeah, if guys would do it, people, it might rub them the wrong way. Maybe some people don't like it. I don't know. They wouldn't tell me probably.
To me, it's very strong. It's very strong. Jazz or no jazz, but certainly in jazz, you're right. Certainly in jazz.
In jazz, it's very not like what people expect. Like generally, people don't do a lot of music videos. And if they do, I haven't seen something like that.
Yeah. Why are you doing music videos? Because you like making them.
I really like making them. Sometimes I ask myself, why am I doing them, and yeah. whether it's a waste of time and money. I'm luckily doing it in like very low budget and able to make it look good because I have friends that are very talented yeah. and we find ways to, you know, make things that don't cost so much money.
Yeah.
But we like making them. I don't like really, like when I release a song, it's a special event and I want to have something fun to share with, not just a picture or like...
Of the song.
Yeah. And I know, I don't know, it's hard for me to not go all the way. But I don't know. I mean, I think people respond very well to it. So I think it's, I feel good about making them. But it's honestly, I'm doing it for my personal, when I put something out that I care about, I like to make a little thing for it that's special and that even deepens the story somehow.
Yes.
I think music is, the music can work totally without it. But for me, it's like, if it's adding, it's something nice to... It makes me feel more celebratory when I share the song. Celebratory? How do you
yeah,
say
it? Celebratory. Yeah, celebratory.
Celebratory. And I like to, when I have a release, to have something that I'm excited to share with.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the main reason I do it. Is it serving me? I don't know. Time will tell. Like, it's kind of hard. You make a thing, like 400 people see, 2,000 people. I don't know. Like, I don't know exactly what my expectations and whether I'm like, you know, it's in jazz. I don't know what will it do for me. I feel people really like live videos in jazz.
There are some conventions in jazz. Live videos, the type of artwork that you do, the yeah. blah, 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 blah. I mean, all of that
I'm
stuff is like...
I'm not doing it. I think I like being the person who's not doing what expected.
Yeah.
But it's also my way to come back to jazz. I can't go back to like lame visuals. I'm sorry, but mostly it's kind of lame. And then like... After being like doing cooler things, I feel like I still love the music, but I want to make the visuals more exciting and fun and like less like in that expected thing.
I mean, part of it is also this idea that, well, jazz is made for people who have stopped being provocative in their life and they want
exactly.
something safe and comfortable. And so the visuals should always be safe and comfortable.
Right.
And that, you know,
I don't like that. I like to make people feel uncomfortable. Like, I mean, I even had someone close to me that like we were working together and he was like, are you sure you want it? Doesn't it make you feel uncomfortable? I love it, but I also sometimes scared to send it to people because they might, you know, respond in a way that's uncomfortable. And I said, I like it. And it's good for me if someone feels uncomfortable.
I mean, that some people would argue that's part of the job.
Exactly. So to me, it makes a lot of sense. Will it serve me to make some live videos? Maybe, and maybe I'll make some. But I'm just saying that it's just for my own pleasure. I just loved making these things, and I love to make people not sure if they like it or not. But like, actually, yes, like it, you know?
Well, Dita Pellet, I can tell you that I actually, yes, liked this conversation today.
I have had so much good time.
This is so fun. Thanks for
yeah.
doing this with me.
Totally. Anytime.
There she was, my friends, Dita Pellet. What a fun person to talk to. You know, when we finished this interview, she said to me, hey, I think we forgot to be friends. Let's be friends now. So, I think we're friends. I'll be back again in your headspace with another deep dive before you know it. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.